You're tuned into the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. This week, we're participating in Covering Climate Now, a global collaboration of 250 media outlets designed to bring attention to the climate change story. We start today with a look at how climate change is affecting the food we eat. Longer heat waves and record amounts of rainfall give way to invasive species and can damage crops. Extreme weather events are happening more often, forcing farmers to adapt their practices. And now, research shows that climate change is actually changing the very soil used to grow crops in this region. So, what does all of this mean for farmers in the region and the rest of us who depend on their hard work? Joining me in studio is Matthew Capucci. He is a meteorologist for the Washington Post Capital Weather Gang. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
The Washington region dealt with several intense heat waves over the summer and storms that caused widespread flooding. How is climate change contributing to our changing weather patterns?
Yeah, so basically we're getting warmer and we're getting wetter. And one thing we're seeing is a lot more 95-degree days and 90-degree days. So we average about 36 90-degree days in D.C. every year. So far this year, we're up to 56, so we're getting hotter. And it's those top-tier heat events that are increasing disproportionately faster than anything else. In addition, we're seeing changes in rainfall patterns, too. So in the past, we'd see kind of more spread-out rainfall, but now we're getting a burst of rainfall and much more narrow, you know, heavier events, and that can take a toll on farmers.
What could this mean? You said it could take a toll on farmers. What could it mean for agriculture?
Yeah, so the way we're seeing climate change affect us both locally and regionally is that we're having the same weather, but for longer periods of time, and then more abrupt switches. So you might have, for instance, a period of 10, 15 days where it's kind of drier than average, and then you all of a sudden revert back to a wetter than normal pattern, and that leaves what's called evapotranspiration to wreak havoc sometimes. So what that means is that plants essentially sweat. They take in moisture, they give off moisture. And when a plant gives off moisture, if more is going out than coming in, the plant can start to dry up, cause issues with soil moisture, and with the plants themselves. And so if you have a drier period of time that lasts longer, that can cause more evapotranspiration without that rainfall coming in. Likewise, on the other side of the coin, you have a wetter period than normal, that can cause issues with roots rotting, that can cause issues with flooding plants. And so it's more that our changes are much more abrupt and much more longer duration than what we've seen in the past.
What's that word, evapotranspiration?
Yes, evapotranspiration.
Just learned a new word today. Also joining us in studio is Nick Marvell. He's an organic farmer and owner of Nick's Organic Farm in Buckeyestown, Maryland. He's also a founding member of the Maryland Organic Food and Farming Association. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Koja.
Tell us about your farm in Buckeyesville. As a farmer, what crops or livestock do you focus on?
Right. Well, we have 175 acres in the Farmland Preservation Program in Buckeyestown, Maryland.
Buckeyestown, not Buckeyestown.
Yeah. We're just across the Montgomery County line. We're along the Monocacy River. We look out over our farm and see the Sugarloaf Mountain. Many people are familiar with that. We raise beef cattle.
Black Angus,
which are 100% grass-fed. We also raise chickens and turkeys, and we also raise eggs, and we grow corn, and we grow soybeans and barley, and we have extensive pastures and hay fields. So we are what's called an integrated farm, which means we grow both animals and crops for our products. And we sell directly to the consumer. We don't tend to sell to wholesalers or stores or anything like that. People come to our farm and buy our products. And we're certified organic.
I was about to say it's a 165-acre certified organic farm, correct?
Correct.
What impacts have you seen from climate change in your daily life on the farm? Have you had to change how you farm over the last decade or so?
Absolutely. I mean, I think Matt sort of put it from the weather perspective. I can give it from the farmer's perspective. It used to be farmers would get together and talk about having a good year. Now we're talking, getting together and hoping for a normal year, and we haven't had one in a long time. We're getting what I call the broken record syndrome. Every few years, we break another record. And sometimes it's back-to-back, Kojo. We go from the driest year on record to the wettest year on record, back-to-back. We go from the coldest spring to the warmest spring, back-to-back. We have these stretches of erratic, from a farmer's perspective, unusual, long hot spell, long cold spell that never used to happen to us. I've been doing this 40 years, and believe me, the climate has changed. So, yes, we have had to adapt our practices. And many of those practices that we're now using are generally referred to as regenerative practices, and they're also definitely in the mainstream of organic farming. So we have to do things differently than we did in the past. Would you like me to give some examples?
Of course.
For example, we don't plant just one type of corn. We plant multiple varieties of corn with different maturity dates. And that's a hedge against weather, because if you don't get the rain at the right time, if you don't get the heat at the right time, corn is very sensitive to degree days and during its fertilization period, very sensitive to when the rains come. So you space it out, so you know you hope you'll get a good time. Well, last year, we had double. That's 200% the normal rainfall. It kept us out of the fields most of the year. We were forced to plant our corn 6 weeks late, and our latest maturing corn, we lost 90% of it because we couldn't get in to harvest it. We had 10 inches of rain in 10 days in October. I mean, it's unheard of. We are in a climate crisis. That's what we're in, Kojo.
Joining us in studio is Dr. Kate Tully, an assistant professor of agroecology in the Department of Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. Kate Tully, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your research at the University of Maryland focuses on soil and farms on the Eastern Shore. Tell us about that work.
Yeah, so some of the work I've been doing recently is looking at the effects of saltwater intrusion, which is kind of like the leading edge of climate change. Down on the eastern shore of Maryland and Delaware and Virginia. And what we see is as sea levels are rising, which they are across the globe, we see these fingers of salt sort of weaving their way in through our canals and our ditch systems. And that brings saltwater upland into areas that didn't previously have it. And a lot of those regions tend to be farmland.
We've all seen the headlines that coastal areas could be underwater as soon as 2050, but you say salty soil could be a major problem much sooner. What does that timeline look like? I was on the Eastern Shore yesterday on the Choptank River, and I was seeing exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so this happens far in advance of saltwater, of sea level rise. And so saltwater intrusion is occurring right now. Sometimes we talk about climate change as something that's going to happen in the future. And really what we're experiencing here in Maryland is climate change in real time and affecting farmers day to day. And so it's going to happen. It's happening now, and it's only going to get worse. I have farmers who are losing land, acres and acres, every single year.
Here's Mark in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Sure. I just appreciate the work of the farmers. I'm a consumer. What I'd like to cite is a peer-reviewed journal. Increasing CO2 threatens human nutrition. Basically, the higher the CO2 content, the lower the concentration of critical micronutrients in a number of crops, wheat, rice, field, peas, etc. And this would have a critical impact on the ag sector. Basically, the higher CO2, forget breakfast of champions. We're going to have breakfast of mush.
Thank you very much for your call, Mark. I see some nods of agreement around the table. But allow me to move on to Caroline in Poolesville, Maryland. Caroline, your turn.
Thank you, Kojo, and thanks to your guests. And this is an important conversation for us to have. Here in Montgomery County's 93,000 acre agricultural reserve, we are feeling the crisis. And as Nick Maravel noted, last year was biblical in terms of precipitation. The good news is, with folks like Nick, with the University of Maryland and other brain trusts, we're coming up with plans on how to address the crisis, on how to mitigate, how to teach our expanding and next generation of farmers about permaculture, regenerative agriculture, building biomass. But this is going to take a commitment, a collective commitment, including from our local jurisdictions, Montgomery, Frederick, et cetera. And we're all in here at Montgomery Countryside Alliance. And Kojo, this conversation is so important. So thank you.
Thank you for joining the conversation. Anyone who care to comment on that at all?
Yes, Kojo. The University of Maryland, places like Montgomery Countryside Alliance, are always sponsoring activities to show additional ways to conduct your farming activity so that you can become more adaptive to climate change. And some of the things that they're finding is that it all comes down to soil health. And so what we like to say in the organic and regenerative community is healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy people. It really works. And it's almost a side benefit that at the same time, you're building your organic matter in your soil and you're attacking climate change. On our farm over the past 20 years, we've increased our average organic matter by 50%. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're actively farming and to go every year and be adding to that bank account of carbon-rich soil, you're taking that from the atmosphere. And if everybody was doing that, we would be decreasing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Nick Marvell is an organic farmer and owner of Nick's Organic Farm in Buckeystown, Maryland. He's also a founding member of the Maryland Organic Food and Farming Association. He joins us in studio with Matthew Capucci, meteorologist for the Washington Post Capital Weather Gang, and Dr. Kate Tully, an assistant professor of agroecology in the Department of Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the effect this is having on wine with Jim Law, who you'll meet after that break. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. In case you're just joining us this week, we're participating in Covering Climate Now, a global collaboration of 250 media outlets designed to bring attention to the climate change story. Today, we're starting with the effect of climate change on agriculture. Matthew Capucci, it's not only heat waves and warmer temperatures that affect agriculture, it's also what happens in colder months. Has there been significant changes to winter weather patterns in our area recently as well, and is that noteworthy?
There has been. So first things first, we are losing snowfall. We used to average about 21 inches of snowfall each year in the district. We're down to about 15 and still shrinking. Nowadays, we only get probably 3 or 4 accumulating events of about an inch or more, so we're not really as much of a winter wonderland as we used to be. Now, another thing that's worth mentioning is the extent to which we're changing the amount of snowfall we get when we get it. So now we're only getting snow in kind of the big events. We're seeing more of those big events, but more spread out over time. So my editor earlier on referred to it as feast or famine, and that's really what we're seeing. Since 1984, we've seen only about 8 seasons above average, but those have balanced out all the rest of the seasons since then, because during those seasons, we got so much snowfall, but only in those short little bursts. Since 1990, we've had 5 of our top 10 biggest snowfalls on record only in the past 25, 30 years here in D.C. So we're seeing bigger storms, but just much more spread out over time.
Are these changes in weather patterns unique to our region?
Not so much. We've been seeing the same patterns in Boston, New York City, for instance. Back since 1990, we've seen 7 of the top 10 biggest snowfalls. And part of it might be due to an increase in moisture over time. So, you know, we're warming up. It's tougher to get snowfall, but when we get it, there's much more juice in the atmosphere to work with. And so there's that. There are changes to the storm tracks, which are favoring bigger storms along the immediate eastern seaboard in the wintertime. So a lot of different moving pieces. We're still trying to figure out exactly the mechanisms behind them, but it's definitely a climate trend we're seeing more of now.
Well, Farmer's Almanac says that we are going to be having a humongous winter, that there are going to be a lot of storms and a lot of snow. What say you?
Farmer's Almanac, that is basically like a voodoo doll. It's like Teresa from Long Island Medium if she was forecasting the weather. There's no skill whatsoever behind it. It's mostly just, you know, a blind squirrel will find a nut once in a while. So don't buy him the Farmer's Almanac. Read Capital Weather Gang.
Thank you very much. If you enjoy a glass of Virginia wine with dinner, you might have noticed an increase in the number of rosé bottles on the grocery store shelves. Joining us in studio is Jim Law. He is the owner of Linden Vineyards and wine grower at Hardscrabble Vineyard in Linden, Virginia. Jim Law, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
You are living with this reality as a winemaker in Virginia. How has the weather over the last year made conditions optimal for this type of wine?
Well, optimal is perhaps not the word I would use, but Last year we made no reds, and we made all those red grapes into rosé. And the reason was because of rainfall. The rain continued throughout the growing season. And in order to make good red wines, you have to have lots of sun and concentration, which you get from drier soils and drier climates. That was not happening. And I've been doing this now for 40 years, and just walking through the vineyard, tasting the grapes, the red grapes, I said, there's no way this is going to work for reds. But it had some freshness. The grapes had freshness. There was good acidity. I said, well, it's rosé. Frankly, 10 years ago, I'm not sure what I would have done, but now there's a big, big market. Everybody wants rosé. So it was sort of an easy decision.
Well, hail is a four-letter word for winemakers. What can your vineyard do to prepare for these types of storms? How can you adapt?
Hail's a tough one. It's everything can be going well, and then within 2 minutes, your crop is destroyed or damaged. I was over in Italy a couple years ago. They're now putting up hail netting, which is just phenomenally expensive. I hope it doesn't come to that. In the meantime, we used to pull a lot of leaves from around the clusters to open them up to air circulation. Now we're starting to leave them as little shields against the hail. That'll help sometimes, but we are seeing increased hail events, and it can be quite detrimental to the crop quantity and quality.
Here is Shoshona in Waldorf, Maryland. Shoshona, your turn.
Hi. Yeah, it's not just affecting crops, it's also affecting livestock. So obviously, more directly related to crops, you've got hay prices skyrocketing as people are just not able to find it because there wasn't enough dry growing season for the hay to dry out and be able to get cut. So I know so many horse people and other farmers scrambling to get hay. And then you also have to deal with the rain in the winter. And if you've got, say, young animals, instead of snow, they'll get drenched and then freeze. It's not easy. The weather has really been screwing a lot of people over when it comes to their livestock.
Nick Marvall, care to comment on that?
Yes, Kojo. That's one of the things we've had to do in the past 2 decades. We very rarely make dry hay anymore. It's both personally stressful because you hate to see a nice hay crop go down and then it gets rained on. But what we have to do is we produce what's called balage, which is the same hay. You roll it up into these big bales that are 4 by 5 feet, and then you wrap them in plastic so it ensiles them, sort of like putting the cork on one of your bottles in the vineyard. And it actually preserves the nutrients a little bit better, and you don't lose as much when you pick up the hay. You get more of the hay picked up. But horse people, for example, don't use balage, and so it's more difficult for them to find hay. But we would never consider going back to dry hay under these weather conditions, because we would only produce very, very poor quality hay.
We got an email from Francesca who says, lost one of my favorite trees this summer from the ongoing effect of last summer's rain. Because of that rain, a soil fungus killed a giant maple in a week. Now, that's amazing, isn't it, Kate?
It is. And one of the things that we're seeing with climate change is it exacerbates a lot of these other problems that we already have. So pine bark beetle. And when you have a tree, for instance, that's already stressed by climate change, it's just going to be more susceptible to fungus or other kinds of diseases.
On now to David in Annandale, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hey, Kojo. Listen, I was listening. I heard one of your guests talk about soil rejuvenation. I think about organics in the soil. And I'm not a farmer or a gardener, but I just got a place about an acre out here, and I'm trying to figure out. I just spoke with somebody from a company who was working next door about what I can do to get, I guess, organics back in the soil, so I can at least raise some, not a plush lawn, but just something besides weeds. I thought, just planting clover would be something I could do, but. And the business models of the businesses around here, though, they don't really want to do that kind of thing. They want to, promote a flush grass, which is completely unnatural to me. I was just wondering what your guests might have to say about, you know, how do you do this? Is there any way to do it on a residential basis for something like an acre?
Nick?
Well, yes. You're absolutely correct that if you want your grass to look like a golf green, for example, and you know, the way that's done is with a lot of chemicals, which are not good for our soil or our water. So what you can do is you can plant things that look more like a meadow. So you get some wild flower mixes. You can also cut your lawn a little bit less frequently. Now, this sometimes creates some discord with your neighbors, but we've managed to do that on our lawn. And you let the natural grasses will come back in. Now, your lawn will not, as I say, look like the country club golf green, but it will keep the soil in place. It'll build your organic matter. It'll serve as a repository for insects that can provide some beneficial effects around your environment. And so it's a good thing. It's a good thing to do. You'll provide sources of pollen for bees and wild bees and domesticated bees. So there are places where you can go and look for meadow mixes, and you'll get grasses and broadleaf things that sort of look like flowers, and you'll get some legumes, some clovers, like you were mentioning. But the key to remember here is it's not a monoculture. When you go to the golf course, it's all one type of grass. And what if we have learned anything in the organic and regenerative movement, it is diversity rules. And that is the principle you should follow. So you should mix it up. In our hay fields, we very often will plant five or six different species. And then we have what I consider the background of wild species that come in along with that. And we think that's just fine.
We got an email from Donna, who writes, "We recently did a bike and barge trip along the Mosel, Germany. We were told that there are certain types of wine they can no longer make because of the change of the weather." Question for you, Jim Law. There's a kind of unpleasant irony occurring here, because wine from Virginia has really got a lot of attention and recognition over the past decade or so. How do you and your fellow winemakers feel about dealing with this new challenge of climate change just when Virginia seems to be having its moment?
Yeah, Kojo, that's an excellent question. I've been doing this for 40 years, and when you're starting from scratch, it's just sometimes feels like an impossible deal, and you work hard, you have obstacles you overcome, and there's hurdles, and I'm feeling at this point in my life like I'm really starting to get it right, and then the climate shifts, and there's somebody it's like you're running the hurdles, and you're heading for the end, and somebody throws another hurdle in front of you. So what we're doing is we're starting a climate change experimental vineyard where we thought we had it right. We chose a land for certain grape varieties, just as the Germans, who have been doing this a lot longer than we have. And we got to figure out what's going to work. And that's going to take decades. So we're going to get started now, planting varieties that might in the future be more appropriate for our site.
Got to take a short break, but we'll be coming right back after that to talk about how climate change is affecting agriculture in this region. If you're part of a crop share, have you noticed a difference in the types of food you receive? I'm Kojo Nand. Welcome back. We're talking about the effect climate change is having on agriculture, and we got a tweet from Brittany who said, "I've also noticed a decline in volunteerism. It's hotter earlier in the day and cooler later, and people, especially our seniors, won't work as often. The one benefit is that we've extended our growing season and grow through December, January." Matthew Capucci?
Yeah, so since about 1970, our growing season extended about 2 weeks in time. So that's good for farmers, but at the same time, that really reflects the increase in temperature we've seen that makes it uncomfortable for people to go outside. During that same time frame, we've got about 5 to 10% more humid, the humidity increasing the fastest out in the more typically dry locations over towards the Appalachians and the rural parts of Western Virginia. So it's something that's noticeable. And it's not just the heat, it's the humidity too. And so add those factors together. It feels about 4 to 6 degrees hotter. It's not getting as cool at night. So it's really just around the clock. We're warming up and it's starting to get noticeable.
And Kate Tully, you lived in Tanzania and you're having an interesting experience here. Tell us about it.
Oh, yes. I lived in Kenya and Tanzania for several years and worked outside many, many hours. And the hottest I've ever been is down on the eastern shore of Maryland in the middle of the summer. The humidity is very, very high. If you're in the marsh and there's no breeze blowing, I can say for a fact that I definitely felt hotter here in Maryland than I ever did in Tanzania.
One indication of what's happening. Nick Marville, you're a founding member of the Maryland Organic Food and Farming Association. What have you heard from other farmers in Maryland about the impact that climate change is having on their operations?
Well, it's constantly a topic of conversation. And it's changed over the years. It used to be just, yeah, well, we got this rainfall, we got that. No, it's changed the entire season. It's changed how people can farm. Matthew was saying how extended the growing season and increased the humidity. That's a two-edged sword, actually. That's allowing insects now who couldn't migrate this far north to continue migrating further north. I'm sure, Jim, you've seen changes in the fungal diseases in your crop because of the increased humidity. So there's just an awful lot that's going on. We hear from farmers that they're cutting back on the types of things that they grow because the weather keeps throwing something new at them and they don't want to take a chance. They want to try to stick with things that they think they can get through with, even with what this climate crisis is throwing at us. So, and they're actively seeking alternative ways of managing their farm to adapt to climate change. And if I might just add, we're having a farm tour next month, the 19th and 20th of October, Saturday and Sunday, out at our farm. And the theme is going to be regenerative agriculture. We have an 8 to 12 year crop rotation, and we rotate our beef and our poultry through that crop rotation. So it comes out a little bit like a Rubik's Cube if you're trying to figure it all out. But we're going to be showing people what these regenerative farming practices are. And how it has resulted in, our ability to try and cope with what's going on. And one of the things that I'm thinking about doing, usually I go around and I repair a little bit of my gravel farm roads. Last year, we had twice, as I said before, the average rainfall. And we got a little bit of erosion only on our roads. It eroded the gravel roads, but because of the way we managed our fields held tight. And I'm going to leave some of that erosion before the farm tour, and I'm going to show people how deep you can erode a gravel road, and the field right next to it is okay because it was covered with cover crops. It had living roots on it all the time. You know, there are things that we can do to help adapt, but it doesn't take away from the fact that we're in a climate crisis.
Indeed, Kate Tully, you've worked with farmers on the Eastern Shore to conduct your research. Some of them have had the same land for centuries. Is there anything the farmers you work with can do to, as Nick put it, adapt?
Yeah. So the history of the Eastern Shore is really fascinating. A lot of the farmers I work with have been living on the land their entire lives. And in fact, their families go back to the 1630s when the first Dutch and British settlers came to the region. And so obviously there's a lot of history and it's very hard to change the practices that you've been doing for centuries and centuries. But that's not going to stop the tides. And so we have to come up with some solutions that are going to keep farmers in business and not completely damage the environment at the same time. And there's sort of three ways that farmers tend to deal with climate change. And one is trying to continue farming as usual. Maybe they want to build up the land to make it higher, try to keep the water off for longer. some farmers are going to adapt. And so some of the adaptation strategies are planting different kinds of crops. So for instance, barley, there's a big microbrew boom on the eastern shore. And malting barley actually does pretty well in salt-intruded fields. Sorghum is another crop that does pretty well. And so farmers are starting to think about different practices that they might need to do on their land. And in some cases, they're actually restoring their lands back to wetlands. And so the entire eastern shore was one giant wetland before we came and started ditching and channelizing the whole area. And so restoring the land back to what it was previously is another really good way to both, if you can, enroll in a program, a governmental program that supports the farmers.
I was about to say, how are government agencies like the Department of Agriculture supporting these farmers?
Right. So we have, there are some programs. There's the Environmental Quality Improvement Program and some conservation reserve easement programs that allow farmers to take what we call marginal land out of agriculture and put it into some sort of restoration practice. That could be trees, it could be some sort of marshland, and we can keep those lands, depending on the contract, in some sort of restoration state for 10 or more years. And farmers can enroll in those programs. They're often it's a cumbersome paperwork process. And so the other strategy that farmers have is just to abandon the land and let nature take her course. And there are benefits to that, and there may also be some negative consequences as well. For instance, species invasion was something that you mentioned earlier on. And so we might actually see more species invasion if we just abandon the land completely because of the fact that with agriculture, we have a lot of weed species and we have a lot of invasive species. So there are some practices that are available to farmers, and some of them are being supported by the government, but we certainly need more of those.
We got a tweet from Siri who says, farmers are on the front line of climate change. Extreme weather is ruining crops, salt water is intruding on farmland, and even hail is destroying wine grapes. No doubt, we'll soon see the effects on rising food prices and shortages. And now here is Joe in Montgomery County, Maryland. Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Joe. Just right off the bat, I'm a young farmer. I'm only about 25. I work for the main farmer. We grow crop about 1,000 acres, and we've got about 200 acres of hay, and actually right now I'm in a tractor cutting hay, so it's a little noisy, I apologize.
Okay.
One of the main things that I've had to deal with being born and raised in Montgomery County is the lack of farmland. Just, we've lost a lot of farmland to developers. Soil conservation is one of the biggest things. I'm also one of the directors on the soil board, and soil conservation is something that I see as a big practice that Montgomery County farmers have been doing for a long time, between crop rotating, no-till drilling, and cover crops. One of the practices that I have brought into with my boss that I work for is that we're doing it this year, and we want to get as much cover crops put over all of our harvested acres as we can this year. We also do an odd crop. We have about 300 acres of sorghum that I am actually in the middle of harvesting right now, along with our cereal grains with corn and soybeans. And soil conservation and climate change are intertwined together, which is something that me as a younger farmer, I think, see very heavily, and something that I'm trying to continue to push with my boss, who is a aging farmer, but he's been a mentor all my life, and I've learned many old techniques from him.
And I suspect that you both will be learning more during the course of the coming years. I interrupt only because we're running out of time. But Joe, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Jim Law, any plans for future weather changes that you're preparing for at your vineyard?
Well, the main thing is that we are looking at different varieties. But the other, it gets down to very specific practices that we use in what we call canopy management, and trying to use the leaves to for more evapotranspiration, as Matthew had mentioned. That's very important to us. We're letting more grass grow. We're letting what used to be called weeds grow under the trellising, which we now call native cover crops. It's a little sexier, but it's the same thing. But we're trying to get certain low-growing weeds that will take more moisture out of the soil. And that's worked out quite well for us, actually. And it does hold the soil as far as erosion because we're on some very steep sites.
And Matthew Cappucci, in the 45 seconds we have left, a lot of people see climate change as an abstract idea that won't really affect them in their lifetimes. What are some of the things you see in your day-to-day reporting that proves it's already having an impact?
Yeah, it's already happening right now. So we're seeing just much more extreme weather. For the most part, all the different things that are going on, the hurricanes are getting stronger, the top rainfall events are getting even more significant. And so it's really just exacerbating ongoing things and making them that much more significant. You know, for example, we've had just since 2003, 36 of DC's top 100 wettest days. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio versus the top tier events now versus in the past. So it's really just extremifying across the board and something that we have to keep an eye on.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Matthew Cappucci, thank you so much for joining us. Nick Marvell, thank you for joining us.
Great.
Dr. Kate Tully, thank you for joining us. And
thank
Jim
you.
Law, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Victoria Chamberlain. Coming up tomorrow, our participation in the Covering Climate Now Media Project continues. We'll sit down with the district's chief resilience officer and find out why some are calling long-term plans for dealing with climate change a social justice issue. It all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, Sydney Grannon, Maura Curry, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi, and our engineer is Natalie Yurov-Lithker. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.